This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've gotten used to hearing about athletes on steroids, baseball giants, track stars, but Lance Armstrong's story has been long-running and controversial, and he has yet to fail a drug test. But it's over. He says he's done fighting. So what comes next? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Migland in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Friday, the 24th of August. Lance Armstrong stunned most of the reporting world when he announced he would end his fight with anti-doping authorities. Accusations of steroid use have followed cycling's biggest celebrity around for years. His decision led to the near-immediate move by the United States Anti-Doping Agency to strip Armstrong of his 7 Tour de France titles and issue a lifetime ban from competitive cycling. Armstrong, of course, though, has become bigger than his sport. He's arguably as well-known for his charitable organization, Livestrong, as those 7 titles he held until today. Not to mention the corporate endorsements that have him peering out of magazines and from giant billboards around the world. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York on what today means for Lance Armstrong, the brand.
This decision means Armstrong loses a lot, but he'll avoid ugly, drawn-out hearings with a long procession of finger-pointing witnesses. Marketing expert Al Moffitt of Worldwide Partners says dodging that spectacle is probably what sponsors wanted.
I think they did take that calculated kind of business decision-making process to say, you're okay, your personal brand is strong. We think you can rise above that and your brand will stand by itself.
You could also say that Armstrong is betting his personal brand is bigger than the Tour de France or even the entire sport. Henry Schaefer of Q Scores says he's right, at least for Americans.
He was the Tour de France, let's put it that way.
But there's an issue for Armstrong. Schaefer's company tracks favorability ratings for public figures. Armstrong is down 2/3 from his 2005 peak, and that's before the most recent news.
He definitely has a strong brand name, no question about it. The problem is, over the past few years, his connection with consumers has been deteriorating.
That makes it a tough call for marketers to hire Armstrong, but analyst Paul Swinan thinks Armstrong will bounce back. He covers sports and luxury brands for Morningstar and is also a serious cyclist.
He captures people's imagination, even if they're not interested in the sport of cycling or the Tour de France in and of itself. So he really is a unique brand in that, you know, he goes beyond sport.
The lifetime ban means no comeback. So beyond sport is now all Armstrong's got. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Mitt Romney could accept the GOP nomination for president as early as Monday. It is the first day of the Republican National Convention. It'll be a big day for the governor. Childhood dream come true, political aspirations realized, and millions of dollars finally unleashed for spending in the general election. The delay is part of federal election law. For his part, President Obama must also wait until he officially accepts the Democratic Party nomination. Sabri Benishour reports from our Washington Bureau.
Steve Ansola-Behar teaches government at Harvard. He says if you think you've seen enough political ads already, just wait.
We're going to see much more campaign advertising so that the candidates can try to persuade those wavering voters.
And Bill Allison with the Sunlight Foundation says get ready for a legion of door knockers and data miners, too.
They have to worry about getting voters to the polls, and they have canvassing operations, and they also have incredible data crunching operations. You know, they buy all kinds of consumer and other data.
But that's all par for the course. This year is different, not necessarily in what the candidates spend on, but how much they'll spend.
For the first time since 1972, both major party nominees are operating outside the public financing system for the general election.
Michael Toner is a partner at Wiley Rhine and used to chair the FEC.
So both candidates now will be able to raise as much money as they can.
You know how many fundraising events for his campaign Ronald Reagan went to in 1984?
Zero fundraising events. A very different era.
It's easier to raise more money in 2012, too. Contribution limits have gone up. They're indexed to inflation now. And all those pleas for cash from the candidates are now on top of the hundreds of millions that like-minded super PACs have been raising. So when the post-convention floodgates open, we're looking at an estimated combined $2.5 billion in spending by November. But to put that in perspective, Americans spent $7 billion on potato chips last year. I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, the Dow gained back almost all of yesterday's losses. We'll have details when we do the numbers. It may not be your vision of a fabulous Friday, but plenty of tax experts and other interested parties spent the day poring over 950 pages of tax documents, all related to Mitt Romney and his former company, Bain Capital. The paperwork was posted yesterday by the news and gossip blog Gawker as part of its investigation into Governor Romney's income and tax payments. Many of the questions arising from those taxes stem from offshore accounts. So we're going to talk with Nicholas Shackson. He wrote a book called Treasure Island, Uncovering the Damage of Offshore Banking and Tax Havens. Welcome to the program.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Well, what do you make of this news surrounding Governor Romney and these pages and pages of documents that were published yesterday?
Well, I certainly haven't looked at them all. There's an awful lot of stuff there. One of the things that struck me in the complexity of these things that Bain is involved in and that Romney has been involved is absolutely staggering. And, you know, people in the financial sector are kind of used to this level of complexity. But for the ordinary person on the street, this stuff is really, really strange.
But if it's strange, that certainly doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with it.
Not necessarily. They don't seem to have produced any major smoking guns. A couple of interesting things have come up. One, there does seem to be confirmation of the use of offshore blocker corporations. This is something that for some time the Romney camp has refused to answer questions about. And it seems likely that Romney has been using the tax havens to reduce its tax bill, but we haven't had confirmation of this.
Is that illegal?
No, it's not illegal. It's not breaking the law. But the Romney camp has said in the past that Romney has paid his taxes by investing in these through these offshore blockers. He pays just as much tax, the very same amount of tax, as if he had invested directly in the United States. If these Gawker documents do reveal that his investments have been routed through these blockers, then that will reveal that to be untrue.
Mm. Governor Romney said today that a lot of large companies make a regular practice of using, you know, these low tax havens to save money. How easy is it for multinationals, wealthy individuals to move their assets overseas in these tax havens?
It's very easy indeed, and it's getting ever more rampant. This is not about moving plant and equipment. This is just about shuffling numbers, really.
What is the problem with offshore banking? I mean, if it's legal, why not do it?
The offshore system of tax havens is bigger and badder than almost anybody realized. Recently, the Tax Justice Network put out a study estimating that there's up to $30 trillion of money offshore. A lot of this activity is not strictly illegal, but it is a lot of it is abusive. This system, the whole system, is profoundly dangerous, profoundly harmful to democracy because it effectively provides escape routes from tax, from disclosure, from criminal laws for the wealthiest elites, who are the ones who can afford to use tax havens, and leaving everybody else to kind of pick up the tab.
If it's that appalling, how is it allowed?
Well, that's always the question that comes back. And essentially, there have been numerous attempts by governments to rein this thing in, and the lobbying power of particularly the financial sector. I mean, the offshore system is, you know, it is the popular imagination. It's a kind of, you know, an exotic sideshow to the global economy where, you know, a few celebrity tax cheats and, you know, mafiosi and stuff roam. But no, today, these days, it's all about the financial sector. This is about Wall Street, and Wall Street loves tax havens. And we've seen the power of Wall Street in, you know, eviscerating reforms. And, you know, essentially, I think that's probably the most important reason.
Nicholas Shackson is the author of Treasure Islands, Uncovering the Damage of Offshore Banking and Tax Havens. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
And for an explainer of what matters in the Romney tax documents and what doesn't, check out a blog post by our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore at marketplace.org. Not a whole lot of big business news this week. Blame it on the fact it's August. Markets were definitely feeling the summer drag. Here to talk about that and a couple of other stories from this week are Catherine Rampell from the New York Times and Lee Gallagher of Fortune Magazine. They are joining us from our New York Bureau. Hello, ladies.
Hi, Tess.
Hi.
So really, you know, the markets have barely been moving the past couple of weeks, but we've got Europe, we've got the fiscal cliff, we've got commodities and gold ramping up, but stocks just kind of sitting there doing nothing. Catherine, what's going on here?
I think markets are waiting for some potential news over the next couple of weeks. Next week, we have this major annual conference at Jackson Hole, mm-hmm. at which Ben Bernanke is likely to be talking about what the Fed might do, if anything, and people are expecting that it might do something to help boost the economy. So I think that for right now, investors are largely holding their breath and waiting until Europe sort of gets back into the rhythm of work rather than vacation,
right.
and seeing what Bernanke says next week.
Lee, how much of Europe do you think is just kind of baked in at this point?
I think it gets baked in about every, I don't know, 4 to 6 weeks when some news event happens.
Right.
But, you know, we've actually had a pretty good go of it this summer. And I agree with Catherine that the markets are kind of waiting on tenterhooks for a lot of things to happen. I would put Europe in that bucket. I mean, the Fed is a big, big deal. Everyone's kind of waiting to see what's going to happen and anticipating a move. So I think if we don't get one, there will be some impact felt there. You know, the rubber's going to hit the road with Europe again come September. And so we'll see some feeling there. I think that the market is, you know, we're not sinking into recession right now, but the market's very, we're far from that, but the market's very vulnerable to big things, and there are a bunch of big things on the horizon.
You know, Catherine, we heard this week that Apple is now the biggest company in the world. I wonder, could that potentially be a problem for them? Are there any downsides to being the biggest company in the world?
Are there any downsides? I mean, I'm sure for right now they're popping champagne.
Right.
I would say that it brings more scrutiny to them. There are higher expectations for how they might be treating their workers, or at least how their contractors in China might be treating their workers, because they have so much market power. You know, for a very long time they've been saying, hey, we're one of many players. To the extent that there are abuses or at least unsavory conditions at a lot of these factories, they're true throughout the electronics industry. And you know, now they can, critics can credibly claim that they actually have a lot of power. And beyond that, you know, this is a company that 16 years ago was on the verge of bankruptcy.
Right.
It's come a long way since then, but it came a long way under the leadership of a very visionary CEO who has passed. So we'll see what happens going forward.
Lee, I wanted to ask you about an op-ed from this week by William B. Harrison, who was one of the architects of the J.P. Morgan Chase merger. He made some arguments about big banks and economies of scale, but he specifically talks about regulation. And his position is basically that regulators are independent, that they are not afraid of Wall Street, and also that they have the resources that they need to do their jobs. Do you agree?
Well, I think that he made some interesting points in that op-ed, among them that some of the banks or the institutions that had the worst problems were not the sort of universal banks. So, you know, places like Bear Stearns or Countrywide or MF Global, certainly. And he made some other interesting points. I don't agree with that point, though. I mean, I think to say that the regulators have resources they need is, I mean, that's just not true.
Mm.
To say that they're not afraid of Wall Street, well, you could certainly debate that. But I think that the recent round of moves by regulators, including failing to move forward on a bunch of things, I think certainly a lot of people would argue with that. But I do think he made some interesting points, all that said.
All right. Catherine Rempel, Lee Gallagher, thank you both, and enjoy your weekend.
Thanks.
You too.
Coming up, would a bigger paycheck really make you happier?
The moment the amount becomes public, all of a sudden your happiness with your salary could be motivated by different things than your happiness with the amount of money that you actually need.
But first, let's do the numbers. The markets ended a losing week with gains after Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said the Fed could act further to help the economy. The Dow rose 100 points, 0.8% to finish at 13,157. The Nasdaq added 16 points, 0.5%, closing at 3,069. And the S&P 500 was up 9 points, 0.6%, ending at 1411. For the week, the Dow lost nearly 1%. The Nasdaq and the S&P were both flat. The markets continued to heap rewards on companies that reported good earnings and punished those that fell short. On the reward side was Aruba Networks, a vendor of wireless networks. It beat fourth quarter expectations. Shares shot up nearly 15%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Things remain kind of quiet in the nation's capital. Congress is still out on break. Things aren't expected to be quiet in Tampa, where the Republican National Convention gets underway. And more summer sports are on the horizon. Tennis players hit the courts in New York City for the U.S. Open. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. The recession has already changed where we live, what we do, and what we buy. Now it's shrinking the size of the American family. At last check, the birth rate was the lowest it's been in 25 years. Eliza Ronald-Tannen reports on why more people aren't bringing up baby in the wake of the Great Recession.
Have you ever thought about exactly how much it costs to raise a child? Or even just to give birth? Shauna Wells has.
Because I'm all about the numbers. My pregnancy cost about 15 grand. All right? And that 15 grand is after insurance.
Her daughter's now 3 years old, and she's the only child for Shauna and her husband, who live in Brooklyn.
I want my daughter to be able to have, at the very bare minimum, what I had, but I really want her to have way more. And so, let's say on average annually, we must have shelled out 45 grand on her.
That's a big price tag, especially for a family without a guaranteed income. Both Shauna and her husband are self-employed. She owns a construction firm. He is a personal trainer. Together, they made about $185,000 last year, and this year's going even better. But they know nothing is guaranteed.
There are ebbs and flows. Sometimes we have it. Sometimes, honestly, we don't. At this point, I'm not feeling like we'll be able to do that for another one. Jesus, how am I going to come up with 40 grand, you know?
To raise a child, not including the cost of college, the average American family spends nearly $250,000. Government figures say that cost has jumped 23% in the last 50 years after controlling for inflation. That's largely because of childcare and healthcare costs.
She's very well insured. We have none. It's very indicative of our time. That's the stuff they don't tell you.
Nobody wants to put a price tag on children, but children are big ticket items.
That's psychologist Susan Newman. She says those costs don't stop at what you spend on the kid. Often, parenting also means sacrificing income.
and there's a distinct motherhood penalty. Mothers are taxed, so to speak, at 7% per child. That's what they're losing in income.
And for the women who put off motherhood for financial reasons, delaying a bigger family sometimes means foregoing one. That's what happened to Frances Yanish, a photographer in Manhattan.
We always just were waiting for the right time, and the right time would have been around when the recession started, and we just decided to hold off.
Now, Frances is 42 years old. Her daughter is 5 and a half and knows she won't be getting a little brother or sister.
I worry a lot about the fact that she doesn't have a sibling. I know that I always regret that I didn't have a second child. I think I will regret that forever. But as long as she's fine, it is just the way it is.
That's the way it is for a lot of families. And sociologists say that means there could be a bigger problem on the horizon. Fewer births today will mean fewer workers to support retirees in the future. In New York, I'm Eliza Ronald-Tannen for Marketplace.
And we asked a simple question on our Facebook page this morning. When you think about having kids, what makes you think twice? If you want to weigh in, go to facebook.com/APM Marketplace. It is Friday, and that means payday for some of you, and the last day in our payday series.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
This week, the Wealth and Poverty Desk has been untangling some of the mysteries of pay in America. The assumption about pay is that we all want more of it. Whoever asked the boss for, you know, a decrease? But there is research suggesting that beyond a certain point, a bigger paycheck is not always better. Marketplace's David Brancaccio reports on a group of friends who gathered to hash out what they really want out of their paychecks.
It's my kind of dinner party, nudity and salary all in one.
I was thinking about you all coming tonight, and it was almost like imagining that we were all going to get naked together.
And that is a priest talking.
And I was thinking, gosh, am I actually going to do it? Am I actually going to share what I make?
Jennifer Cresswell, Episcopal priest in Portland, Oregon, and her husband Ian Desher, who works in marketing, have invited four friends on a summer night to see if anyone might bear their salary. We'd asked our audience via our public insight network about salary and happiness. Cresswell wrote back saying she'd often, quote, fantasized about inviting friends over to talk about how much they make and their priorities for spending, sharing, saving, which sounded like a fine idea.
I've been broke for a long time. I learned how to live broke, my early 20s.
We're really good at broke.
I was great at it,
Ryan McCauley works at a Boys and Girls Club. His wife, Shanna, is a second Episcopal priest here. We'd sent a link to a Princeton study that found that more money doesn't make you happier once household income hits $75,000 a year. It's when that $75,000 comes up that Shanna and Ryan become the first couple to bear their paychecks.
Not that much, actually. We together make just under $65,000. I did it! I broke the barrier! I feel like we're pretty low middle class. I mean, we're middle class because we have expendable income, but we were just going through our bills and it doesn't look good.
We're high low class.
A lot of clergy here. Jenny Ott is a pastor at the United Church of Christ. She reveals her household income is $57,800 while her partner Hillary is in graduate school.
It would be nice if we had more. It would be nice if we could just, I don't know if it's 75 is going to be the magic number or what, but we have enough.
Kinda. Just barely.
It's been nice to also live off of the generosity of friends like you guys who have said, hey, we have storage for you so you don't have to pay $150 a month for a storage unit while we live in 500 square feet trying to save money.
The Princeton study found that happiness peaks at $75,000 by studying people who'd been asked, how happy were you yesterday? But that same study also looked at life satisfaction. And in that case, there was no upper limit. The bigger your income, the more satisfied you feel about your life as a whole. Dinner party hosts Jennifer and Ian say their compensation is rising, but they don't feel any more or less satisfied or happy.
We expand into our new salary really easily.
We've been hearing folks at the party thinking about income in terms of what it buys you. But experts say there is another way to think about it.
And then there's happiness with the salary, which is telling you about yourself and telling other people about you.
Daniel Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at Duke and author of Predictably Irrational.
The moment the amount becomes public, all of a sudden your happiness with your salary could be motivated by different things than your happiness with the amount of money that you actually need.
Because comparisons, if not envy, creep in. Ian starts thinking his paycheck should be bigger during boys' night out with his buddies, including one who's in tech, another a healthcare executive.
I pretty much assume that all of them make more than I do. I mean, I honestly think that hanging out with them more since we've moved back to Portland was one of the things that made me think, like, I should be making more.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
You know.
And you should. Wow.
Well, I realize we haven't yet shown ourselves naked. So,
I know we haven't.
So we probably make a combined about $106,000 mm-hmm. a year.
$71,000 for Ian, $35,000 for Jennifer's part-time work as a priest. To do the brutal math here, $106,000 a year is 63% more than the household income of Shanna and Ryan across the dinner table.
Well, I think it creates a little bit of separation, you know, knowing that you have more means than we do, and so we're not there yet. We have been trying to kick it together to buy a manufactured home, and like that's our big dream right now, and that seems like so far off. But on the other hand, I mean, it still makes you human. You're not superhuman. You're not making millions of dollars a year.
And to be clear, the typical income in America, the median, is less than $52,000. This year, when a polling firm looked at income and well-being, it found that when you get below that $50,000 level, happiness goes down the tubes. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
And as David mentioned in his piece, we found Jennifer and her friends through our Public Insight Network. If you'd like to add your voice to the conversation about pay and what it means, go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, you know how when you mail something, a package, they always ask whether you want insurance? Well, you may or may not say yes based on what's in that package. But if you're shipping, say, a Rembrandt etching, a real one worth around $8,000, you'd probably get the insurance, right? Well, a Norwegian art gallery decided to forego the insurance, and now that Rembrandt is lost somewhere in the country's postal system. Oops. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 100 points, 0.8%. The Nasdaq added 16 points, 0.5%. And the S&P 500 rose 9 points. That is 0.6%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. JJ Yor is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Thinking about having a kid? Consider the costs.
One is a hobby. Two, it's getting real. Three, you're in a minivan. It's expensive. Daycare, diapers, clothes, mommy and me, gymnastics. Ugh, goes on.
Baby-proofing your finances. I'm Tess Vigeland. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.